Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am so looking forward to talking today with Michelle Bates. Michelle is an artist, but she's also kind of a mystery to me because it's kind of like her work. She's a photographer, and if you go to Swiftwater to see her beautiful photographs, they'll be in black and white, and they'll all have a bit of mystery to them. They're not super clear, but that's not the point of her art, because she's been making these pictures, and they are gorgeous, with a plastic Holga camera. And it opens up the world, and I really invite you to go look at them, because you'll see it doesn't take fancy gear to create art. It takes an eye. And so I love your work, Michelle, and thank you so much for joining me. Yeah. So if you were to tell the world in a sentence or two who you are, would it be artist, photographer? Tell me, how do you describe yourself?
I don't usually do it in one sentence, but I'm definitely a photographer. And I also kind of always consider myself a scientist, because you never really take that out of a person.
What kind of science?
Just basic sciences. I have a degree, and I worked in biotech and things like that for a while. But I think it's a way of thinking. And in science writing and technical writing. But as an artist and a photographer and a teacher and somebody likes to collaborate with other artists in my work.
Artist, teacher, scientist, collaborator, that's already a lot. Now, you have a degree in science.
Mm-hmm.
Do you also have a degree in arts?
Nope. I never did formal studies, but I stumbled into a place called the Maine Photographic Workshops, which is now the Maine Media Workshops, in 1991, and spent a summer there and just learned a ton. Got exposed to world-class photographers and lots of students, and my little funny little Holga camera.
Holga camera.
Yeah, there. And darkroom work and so much more.
Oh, in Maine, like the other side of country,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Maine, state of Maine. And so I've taken a lot of workshops there and in other places over the years. And that's been my training in photography.
That's so cool. I was amazed. I didn't realize, I'm not that knowledgeable. And I didn't know that there was a whole world related to the Holga camera until I saw your art and I bought your book. And so also I want to say to people, buy the book, because it's fascinating. It's got amazing pictures that are done with these lightweight plastic, meant to be throwaway cameras in a certain sense.
They're reusable. They're reusable. I mean, they're not going to last forever, but.
And yet, fantastic things have come out of them. And it appears like there's been a whole group of artists and almost a cult following around these cameras over time. Is that true?
Well, there's a whole range. In the 60s and 70s, some fine artists found these cameras and started using them in that context. And since then, people have used them for everything. And so what I did in this book, in the first edition and then the second edition, has 50 different photographers in it. And I tried to choose people doing the best work with these type of cameras, this genre of cameras, in lots of different types of photography. So there's photojournalists and there's commercial photographers and editorial, in addition to lots of fine art photographers.
So why would a photographer who could have access to different cameras, because cameras aren't all that expensive, a lot of us are doing a lot of work with their iPhone, why would they choose a Holga, a plastic camera?
Mm-hmm. Part of it is the look of the images. And, people will say, well, you can get any look that you want on the computer now. And so part of it is, what do you want to be spending your time with? Do you want to be on the computer all day long? You can do whatever you want on the computer. Or do you want to be out in the world making images? And with a Holga, if I brought one here for you to touch, but people on the radio can't touch it. But
and let me just say, it's like super cool, super light. You hold it and you feel like, is this really a something? Because it's so light, but it also feels like a camera. It looks like a camera. It looks like a camera like they used to look.
Yeah, yeah, but lighter even, because cameras even. Used to, the old-timey cameras kind of looked like this, black and boxy, but they were metal, and this is plastic. In other parts of my life, I eschew plastic, but this is my world with the cameras. It's got a spring for a shutter and a single plastic lens. So the results are unpredictable. So even if you were to try and sort of create something like this on the computer, there's an interaction with reality and the quirks of the camera and the lens that gives you unexpected results in the real world. And so I'm not like a generative artist where I can sit with a blank slate or a canvas and create something like so many people here on the island who are painters or whatever. That's not me. I react to what I see in the world. And then the camera is something that either with a regular camera, I can sort of interpret things quite literally, which is also part of my work. And different realm of what I do. But with the Holga, there's an interpretation, and sometimes it's flair. But the images are square-ish. They're kind of roundy. They look more like an old TV set, which young people wouldn't even know what that looks like, right?
Old black and white TV set.
Old black and white TV set, although I can shoot color in it. But that kind of roundy, square-ish, roundy edges. And vignetting, like the corners are kind of darker and the middle is sort of sharper, and then you'll kind of like flare or light leaks or different effects. And so there's just an unpredictability to it, which is why you have people who are old grizzled photojournalists who get bored of everybody shooting with exactly the same gear and getting exactly the same type of pictures. And then with this, you can get something different that stands out. And in the fine art world, that's something that's, you know, you always want to stand out. Now, there's a lot of people that use these cameras and shoot them in very similar ways. So you'll see a lot of work with these cameras that is indistinguishable as far as who took them. But what's the sweet spot is somebody using an interesting tool who also has an interesting and distinctive artistic vision. And then you get beautiful work, which is what I tried to represent in the book and what I try to do personally.
Mm-hmm. So this is so interesting because you have a background in science, and you've also done the kind of work that requires exactness.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, when you're dancing with your Holga, you have to be willing to let go of control because you don't know when that light is going to come in, and you don't know when something fluky is going to happen that is going to create the magic, but it's not in your control.
Right. I mean, it's wacky, isn't it? I mean, it is. You have a lot of scientists and medical type professionals in photography because it's a technical art. So there is an attraction to the gear and techie things and playing with the toys. And I'm like that. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the technical aspects of it. I also enjoy communication. So like the book is a way to communicate technical information to anybody, you know, photographers and non-photographers. So I enjoy that kind of translation. And so I don't want to be just in that world. I like crossing the world. So I like, you know, doing my photography with artists who don't know anything about the photography, but I'm creating with them. And so, and I like taking the technical information and presenting it to lay people, you know, non-technical photographers. And also I like, you know, using a tool and using all of my knowledge, but then not having total control over the outcome. And you do learn a lot, and you can have much more of a sense of what you're going to get with the Holga the longer you use it and the more kind of scientific you are about how you use it in a way. Although I've seen some people go way off the deep end with that, trying to really control the results out of a Holga, but that's not me. I'm somewhere in between. I don't know. It's a joy. It's really fun. You know, you go out and you shoot and it just makes this little click, and then there's nothing else to do. There's no looking at the image to see. You just go out and continue on your way and doing what you're doing.
Are you shooting film?
It's film. Oh yes. Yes. It's film. It's film. Yeah. So you don't even see your results until later, you know, until you process the film.
Amazing. And do you go through any kind of process before you go out and shoot to sort of enter into that other world
It is challenging to get into that world, like putting on photography eyes. It is very hard to do when there's other people around or when I'm in normal life or like at home. You know, I haven't shot a lot on the island, which I want to, because it would be really fun to have images of the island at Swiftwater. Mostly it's on road trips and when I'm traveling, and then I get kind of in the zone where I can be looking. But it is definitely a very specific mindset and not easy to get into. And sometimes even on a road trip, it takes a couple of days to get there.
Can you describe the mindset that you would optimally like to have?
Partially it's my eyes, like how I'm looking, and partially it's a willingness to stop and take the pictures. Because sometimes I've seen images that are amazing, and then whatever is going on, the people I'm with or my state of mind or whatever, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to stop, I'll whatever. And then I miss it. And then I regret it because I've missed these images. I could even tell you about some of them that I've missed. But the amazing moments are when you're looking and you've got time and there's somewhere to pull over and you've got the camera with you and you've got the film, and then you can make the images. But it kind of takes all of those parts. So yeah, I don't always have a Holga with me, but, you know, I should. And then I'm not always looking because I'm just in daily life.
I was wondering, because having, again, I really love your art, and having seen it at Swiftwater and in your studio, on the studio tour, it's often there's often a dreamlike quality, like you're inviting me into a realm. And so I was wondering if that's part of the mindset too. You know, it's almost like sometimes you want to squint your eyes or do something that gets you out of the straightforward look ahead, see what's ahead of you, kind of reality that most of us operate in most of the time. So I was just wondering if you even have to kind of adjust your eyes so that you...
Yeah, kind of. It is that looking. And it's also, you know, I've got like a million cameras of all different types and shapes and sizes and film types and digital and all this kind of stuff, you know, from teeny weeny little mini miniature cameras to 4x5 cameras, film size, 4x5 inch, and so many different things. And so sometimes if I'm on a trip, I'll have different size cameras with me and different formats. And then that gets hard too, right? Because you're like, what do I shoot this with? And what do I shoot that with? And, but yeah, so it is a mindset of going out and looking and seeing like what will translate into an image with the Holga that is something that's interesting to me. And sometimes it like fits into series of work that I have, because that's nice to have work that relates to other work. Although sometimes it's nice to have completely different types of images too, but what will work, you know, there's a very specific way that I shoot the Holga, where my images, my subjects are mostly centered, which kind of breaks the rules of what the books say, you know, don't center your image and do your rule of thirds and your, you know, all this kind of stuff. But that's just not how I shoot. So it takes a while to be able to see and recognize what's something that would work. And then also just looking for those moments, like there's, you know, on a road trip in January, we were driving on the peninsula and by Lake Crescent, and the weather just did this amazing stuff with this clouds, and it was reflecting in the lake, and it was just stunning. It was just one of those moments. So I stopped, you know, several times along the lake and shot it as things were changing, and those moments. So when you're there at that moment and you can shoot and hope it comes out well, because it's very unpredictable. You can shoot, you can see something fantastic, and then you shoot, and then you process the film, and then you look at it, and you're like, oh, it's not quite right, you know, but you do your best.
Well, and there's the excitement factor, because I can remember from shooting black and white 50 years ago. You know, that moment when you finally saw the film coming forward, saw what you got. And it's a whole different feel than looking at the 100 pictures you took in the last 2 minutes.
No, I mean, it's like everything all at once, because it's like when you see an image that really gets what you were going for and you know is going to work, it's just thrilling. And then there's sort of always the sort of culling of the possible. So when you shoot, between when you shoot and when you see the film, like anything is possible. And then when you see the images, like all the other possible images go away and you just have what you have. And sometimes they're really great and sometimes they're a disappointment. So you have to come to terms with that every time you see a roll of film that you've processed.
Now, do you doctor the images once they you have them on film? Do you manipulate them at all?
I'll usually scan them just to the negatives, like really simply, just to see what I have, until I go in the darkroom. But my prints that you'll see in the gallery and framed are all darkroom prints. So super analog, and there's not a lot I can do in there. I will do some, you can change contrast and you can burn and dodge. So, you know, maybe darken the sky and add a little drama to clouds, but I don't do a lot. There's not a lot that you can do in the darkroom compared to what you can do digitally. There are some things, but that's not what really what I want to do. I like things to be easy and to just print them.
It's like a different part of your brain. I know I love the artist designer Austin Kleon, who wrote this book Steal Like an Artist. He has all these observations that are just wonderful about art and design, and I think he has two sections to his artist office studio. One is analog, one is digital. And he moves between worlds because he needs both and he uses both. But giving a special honoring of the world of analog, I think, is really exciting because we've been so digitized, mm-hmm. as if the whole world can be Photoshopped now. And to realize that there are spaces that are still just analog, I think it opens our minds.
Yeah. I mean, I do both. I have all the digital cameras and I shoot a lot of theater and performance, and that's this whole other world, which is people are on Vashon are familiar with realm as well. And I'm on the computer and I'm on Lightroom mostly and a little Photoshop of tweaking things to make them look right. And I have a mixed relationship with that. I don't particularly enjoy hours and hours of editing on the computer, mm-hmm. but I do it because I need to, and that is what makes sense for that work. I used to shoot all that on film, and I used to print in a color darkroom and make those prints back when I was shooting UMO in the 90s. I still have film and negatives and contact sheets and prints that I made in a color darkroom of them, and it's a lot of work and it's a lot harder. So to properly represent what we're doing and to give them the final result that they need, that's just all digital now.
How did you come into that relationship with shooting performers and specifically UMO? Had you been doing that? What led you there? Because you have quite a prolific body of work now with island performers and especially UMO.
Uh-huh. And just to say that I will always love darkroom, and I'm even building a new darkroom, so I'll never stop that. But this other world, it was 93 or 94, something like that. A friend of mine worked for an organization that was doing a fundraiser and asked me to photograph it. And UMO was there roving as their buffoons. And I just fell head over heels in love with them. Everything about the buffoons, I absolutely loved it from the first moment, and I still do. And so I photographed them there, and I just basically followed them home. and said, let me shoot you. And I came out to Vashon and photographed Digging, the work they were working on then, and them at Bumbershoot. And then just continued to work with them over the years and shooting them first in black and white film and then color film. Kevin Joyce asked me to do an image for a solo show he was working on back early days then, called A Pale and Lovely Place. So I did an image of him at a piano. This is creepy character. Y'all might have seen this image. This creepy character at a piano. And I was standing on the bench shooting down at him with a film camera. And I didn't really know what I was doing. But the images were just so cool. We just both were like, wow. And he really actually used the images to inform the character. So they're even more accurate to the character than they would normally be. And he's actually since reprised that show, and we did a gallery of prints of the images from that and then did new ones and whatever. But I've just never stopped working with UMO all these years. And eventually I followed them out to Vashon and moved out here in 1997.
When did you start working with them?
I think I met them in 94 or so. And a friend of mine had moved out here, and then they came out, and you know, so.
Wow, what a history.
Yeah. And then I also got involved with the Fremont Arts Council, which was, they had an event in Fremont called Miracle on 34th Street, which was a fundraiser event that was a miniature golf courses made by artists and sponsored by organizations or companies. And so the Artist Republic of Fremont had one with the troll and the little bridge that went up and down, and I was photographing, and Mac DeVee, who was involved in the Fremont Arts Council, was there, and he basically was like, come to the Fremont Arts Council. And so he drew me in and then had me photographing their trolls, these trolls that character costumes, and they went out to when the PCC opened, and then I photographed the Solstice Parade, and anyway, they all sucked me in, and then they took me to the Oregon Country Fair, and Uma was there, and I met and the marching band there, and the Flying Karamazov Brothers, and the Royal Family du Canada, and all these groups, and I still go to Oregon Country Fair and photograph, and through all of those people in Fremont, and then I got involved with the Moisture Festival, which is a festival that grew out of Oregon Country Fair and New Old Time Chautauqua and the Flying Karamazov Brothers and Moisture Festival. They all kind of are related. So I got involved with all of those, and I photographed all of those. And, you know, it's just ridiculously fun. And the art, you know, the art that they are doing is beautiful, and I get to help represent that artwork and make cool images and help that. All of that get out in the world, and other people get to enjoy that. And so that's the dance that I like. I like to help the artists get their art out in the world, and help other people find out what's going on to come see it. And then in the middle there is these images that are unique, you know, to both the performance that's ephemeral and the experience of people being there. But then these images are there as well, so they're like this other element. It's a lot of fun.
It's so interesting to me because it's like a whole other side of art. Because here you have your Holga art, which is you in relationship to a camera, trying to stop, be quiet, take photos by yourself, or, you know, traveling with whomever. But it's more of a solo affair. And then you have art and community, where you're right in the middle of it, in the thick. You're making art, but you're really helping artists, and you're creating a momentum around their art that has a whole different energy to it.
Well, but the thing is that it's not as separate as it seems, because in the Holga world, I'm not just a solo artist. And I know a lot of photographers and artists who it's like they make their artwork and then they have to sell it out in the world. And that's challenging. And you have to keep representing yourself and be like, look at me, look at my artwork. You know, like, and for me, I wouldn't be able to do that for too long. So what I have ended up doing is like sharing the Holga love with the world. So I started doing talks and lectures and workshops about it. And then I wrote a book, and then another version of the book. And so I'm not sure how long I would have kept doing the Holga work if it was just me.
So
because I am a social person, and it's the same kind of thing, but in a different direction, where I am giving to people the joy of the Holga and this other cool thing that I'm, you know, so it's like I'm just sharing all the art and mixing it up, putting it all in a big mixing chamber. And then I get to do fun things, like I've done a ton of this, of going and giving a talk, but then I have a show or work in a show in conjunction with that, or teaching a workshop, you know, all over the country and even internationally, where I get to come and play with people. And show my work and be like, look, are my photos cool? But it's also about like, hey, come play and play with this camera.
That's so cool. That's so cool. So it seems like come play could be your middle name. You know?
Yeah. And then I've been on the boards of multiple arts organizations. From I used to run the gallery at the Blue Heron. And I was on the Vashon Allied Arts Board and New Old Time Chautauqua and Isle Wild and the Lookout Arts Quarry, and like many arts organizations. So I'm also organizational, and I like meetings with cool people doing cool things and helping the arts organizations to thrive, and photographing artwork for visual artists. And so helping them get their work out there, and also teaching them how to photograph it. So it's a lot of it is collaborative.
Yeah. And I'm saying, how do you sleep?
I know. Well, you know, what's funny is I feel like, you know, I hang out with a lot of performers, and they have to be like, a million hours of rehearsals for these shows and working together really, really closely to create their work outside of solo performers. And I'm like, oh, how do they do that? I couldn't do that. You know, I do brief dances. You know, I dance with them, but briefly, and I do my own work, and I'm not dependent on them in the same way that you are when you're in an ensemble or even in a cast together working with people. So,
wow. So, this may be too general to ask, but what is art for you? And what would you just say to a younger person or an older person? Doesn't really matter. In fact, an older person might be more interesting, who's just wanting to expand their creative expression. Any thoughts that you would have?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different thoughts. You know, one is I know a lot of what I call artists with a capital A, and they're people who just cannot help but create. No matter how difficult it makes their life, we know some of them, you know, they just can't stop creating. They're generative. They're always coming up with ideas. They just would curl up and die if they couldn't create. I'm not really that, but I do enjoy it. And it helps if I have an outlet and other people who are kind of into what I'm doing and that there's a dialogue going on there. But there's all range of people in what they want to create. And there's kind of a, you know, there's the love of creation. And then there's the sort of trying to either be successful at it, quote, getting it out in the world. And then there's also like trying to make a living at it. And they're all really, really different things. And so it's good to separate that out, because I think there's an expectation that if you like art, then you should be good at it and that you should be able to make money at it. But none of those are necessarily related. Like, you can make art just because it's what you want to be doing with your hands and your time. And that's great. And nobody even ever has to see it. And it doesn't need to be very, quote, good or whatever, because that's what you're doing. You can knit all day long, or, you know, who cares what it looks like, you know, if that's what you want to be doing. And that's, you know, kind of the difference between doing darkroom work and computer work. It's like, really, what do you want to be doing with your time? And then there's, does it matter to you if other people like it or if other people take it home with them? And does it matter to you to make money at it? They're all just, they should be really separate, and people should really think about their wants and needs for all those different things separately, because they get mushed together too easily. And it is extremely difficult to make a living as an artist in this society at this time. This is not a society that supports visual artists or really artists of any kind until you've gotten successful, and then you can make a gazillion dollars. But that's an extremely small slice of people. There are other countries and places and cultures and places in the world right now where they do. The government supports artists and they support that. It's just not now. So, if you can separate out your love of art and don't allow the feedback, whether, you know, like feedback or monetary feedback, to affect whether you're doing it and whether you enjoy it, whether you love it, then that's good. And then figure out how else to eat if you're not going to make money out of it.
I think that's really brilliant, Michelle. I'm gonna take that idea, because I immediately saw it like a Venn diagram, you know, or three circles, right? That might overlap and might not overlap. But what you were saying rang so true that I think we mush them together. And so people will say, you know, are you an artist? Well, are you making money? You know, it's like such a quick thing. And like, oh, can I be an artist or an emerging artist or in love with art and not necessarily have any recognition and not make money at it, but I'm still that? Or can I say, yeah, I'm up to making money. I want to be professional, but that's going to require a whole other set of skills.
It does. It does. And that's also something that's very, very clear, that no matter what your art is, the skill set to get it out in the world and get attention and get it out there is another skill set. And then making money at it, like running it as a business, is a totally other skill set. And there's very little training for those. There's a group called Artist Trust that supports individual artists, and they have training courses in that, but there's not much else out there. And a lot of artists just aren't computer oriented. They're not business oriented. They're not any of, or even don't even, some of them are like really introverts and they don't like talking to people, and really actually talking to people is really helpful in getting your work out there, you know?
Right, right.
So, you know, what you end up seeing as far as the people being successful and having their work out in the world or making money at it is not the best artists. It's the people who are the best business people and the best schmoozers and the people who are out there and the people who just enjoy interacting with people, but also, you know, either by just natural talent or by training, know what it takes to get their work out there. So in the photography world, there's this whole thing called portfolio reviews, which I don't know if they have this in other art realms, but in photography they do, where you have events and you bring together a bunch of photographers who have their work and then a bunch of people who are interested in photography, whether they're publishers, museum people, gallerists, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have this, you have little like 20-minute meetings one-on-one. You have a little lottery system who you get to look, show your work to. And that's a really good way to get your work out in the world. And especially for people who aren't good at sort of getting out there individually, but even then you have to be able to talk to people. And, you know, anyway, it's actually, that's a really good bridge for people because it's a kind of an equalizer that everybody gets their one-on-one time.
Well, that's that actually sounds really useful as long as people know how to give feedback. Because sometimes I think in the art world, people do these critiquey things like, you know, I wouldn't be offering you anything if I didn't slice you down the middle and, you know, and
well,
give you,
you
all
know,
these.
The people who run these portfolio reviews, they try to get good reviewers, and the reviewers get feedback. And the people who are like kind of not helpful in giving feedback in these reviews don't get invited back.
Well, that's
so
good.
It's actually
like
a really
that.
Good scene. Yeah. There's one in Portland called Photo Lucida and the one in Houston called Photo Fest. And there's lots of, and Photo Center Northwest sometimes does little mini ones. And that's a really good way for photographers to get their work out there.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Because I sometimes have thought, you know, I know people who've had great experiences in art school, and I know people who've been decimated by art school. And I think a lot of it depends on how spirit snuffing the critiques were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's
mm-hmm.
some people seem to need to kill your spirit, and others know how to give you that one piece of affirmation and then that one good point that feels like you've gotten gold.
Yeah.
You know, your spirit's alive, but you know what you can do next.
Well, just like everything else we were talking about, being a teacher is a totally separate skill from whatever it is you're teaching.
A fourth circle for us.
Right. You know, and so the people who teach workshops or review work or even run galleries or whatever, they're, you know, they're just the whole range of people. And so, you know,
yeah,
if you're studying or trying to learn from people, and even like a lot of famous photographers teach workshops in the workshop world, and people flock to the workshops because they're famous photographers, but they're not all good teachers. And so you might have a much lesser known person who's a really much better teacher and will help further you in what you want to do than your famous person.
That's a good reminder, because there's greatness in teaching.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, it's huge, and it's totally different, again, you know, from what it is you're teaching.
Yeah, and we're lucky we have, I can't mention them all, but we have some great teachers here on the island. And thank you. I know you're out there.
Uh-huh.
Well, there was one other point you were mentioning that I think is super important, and it makes me think a lot. The relationship of community to art and how we support our independent artists. Because you were saying in Europe and some other places, mm-hmm. there are subsidies, there's encouragement, there's ways. And here it's kind of like each person for themselves. And you and I have mutual friends on the island who, you know, have to go hand to mouth and take out the begging bowl periodically to mm-hmm. get their work out there. And you think, there's got to be a different way or a change in mindset.
It is. Well, there's a lot. It's very odd about this society where you have just this given that certain people are worth, you know, many hundreds of dollars an hour because they went to, you know, for example, law school, you know. And what about people who spent, you know, that much time learning how to, you know, take good photos or make their art or be performers? And why is that not worth anything? And you get into situations where if I'm photographing things that other people like to photograph, like I photograph a lot of circus and things like that. There are other people who like to photograph it and they're willing to do it for free. And then it's hard, gets harder to charge money. And for the performance groups to, you know, they're like, well, we can get it for free. Why should we pay you? And it's like, well, you guys want to get paid. And a lot of people eat it. But then there's a lot of people who want to have the performers do stuff for free. Because, oh, well, you love what you're doing, so you should want to do it for free and we'll give you exposure, you know, that word. And so why do we get to value, you know, people who are out there sucking money out of the money system by just moving money around in the financial world and becoming very, very wealthy, and not, you know, people who are out there creating or doing the day-to-day work that makes society hum and things like that. It's crazy making. And you go to other places where there's a lot of, in Ireland, there's an arts council that does a lot of support. And I think France does that. And you know, everybody participates in the arts. Everybody consumes the arts. Even if you never go to theater in your life, you watch TV. Who do you think created that? Those are writers. Those are directors. Those are actors. Those are cinematographers, right? Those are all artists. But people seem to think that they shouldn't have to support people doing that or support people who are lower down in their careers, who are just learning. So yeah, okay, people will give a lot of money to the opera, but who supports, you know, somebody who's studying singing or, you know, or people who are in big fancy galleries, but then do you support people who are just starting out as artists? Like mm-hmm. they need support too, even more. It's very depressing.
Yeah, we're in a transitional landscape where we just have to find our own creative ways, because certainly this is not working. And, you know, when I was getting ready to independently publish my book last year, Meeting the Muse After Midlife, I took a long walk with a really close friend, and I was saying, you know, I feel so ambivalent about fundraising, you know, cause it just, mm-hmm. it's not my cup of tea. And so she said, Sally, your friends have been behind you for 6 years on this project. Let us stand behind you. Mm. And with that little push, I went out and I thought maybe there's a new model that in a community, independent artists can ask or do fundraising. But also, you know, because the community needs to support it, you know, like mm-hmm. community-supported agriculture, you have community-supported artistry. Mm-hmm. And I did fundraise, and it was a really interesting experience and mostly great. But when I was doing it, I realized I was making a pact with myself that I was going to support independent artists. Mm-hmm. It was almost like for anything I took in, I was going to be ready to give it, because that keeps the, mm-hmm. it keeps the economy going. You know, if you feel like I will take in, but I will give. And if somebody comes and they knock on my door and they say, I'm doing my fundraiser or my Shunpike or my GoFundMe, I'll just say, okay, mm-hmm. that's how we keep the thing going, is if people support each other, not because you're the best and the brightest and the top of the league, almost because you're not.
Right. But that's just, it's a good way to live. And it's not just in money, like you give me money and I'll give you money and we'll pass the money around. It's day-to-day life. I mean, it's why I love Vashon. It's why I always pined to be back here when I wasn't living here, you know, because in other places it's, you know, everyone for yourself. And here there's just much more of a culture of giving and accepting and, you know, being able to share in the burden of life and the joys. And, you know, I love helping people out, like, and I enjoy when other people are able to do something that makes life easier for me. Like when I feel like when somebody does something for me that, you know, I otherwise would have to do, and maybe I'm not good enough or I don't have time or whatever, it just feels like magic to me every time, even whether or not I'm paying them. Even if I'm paying them, it still is like so exciting. and then I love to be able to do that for other people. It's really yeah. fun. And so that can be financial, but it can also be, you know,
it's emotional, it's supportive, it's community. And mm-hmm. and it's so interesting, because when you look at what sustains people over the long run into their elder years and mm-hmm. all, it's community. Mm-hmm. It's engagement. I think it's also creativity and being able to express yourself, mm-hmm. but feeling like you're part, you know, you've yeah. got community around you. It's so vital to our health and who we are, and yet underappreciated, I think, sometimes.
Well, I think that, the kind of standard of individualism and the nuclear family that, you know, is the sort of main cultural, you know, zeitgeist in here and now is just weird and unusual and very, very new. You know, through all of human culture, I feel like we've lived more in community. And so some of us are going, well, that's a better way to do it. And
yeah.
So that's what we want to dedicate ourselves to.
And the other thing you're reminding me, or you did a few minutes ago with some of your imagery, just as a background, I have a business degree and I went to business school and blah, blah, blah.
That's so handy.
Well,
I wish I did.
It is handy. It was great preparation. And in retrospect, I'm really grateful for it. But yeah. It also tracks you into a certain world that is organized, that is left brain, that at the time was largely masculine and wasn't too interested in things like creativity, community, and collaboration, you know, at least at that time. And so, but it had a lot of good things too. But then when you flip your screen and you see the Oregon Country Fair, I've never been there, but I've heard about it, or the Moisture Fester, because I have been, and I went to an Avner workshop, and I was surrounded by these crazy guys that I loved who were jugglers and clowns, and they were living in an alternate reality. And for a few days, I was in that alternate reality. And it spoke a lot more to wild creativity and not knowing and not controlling and community and a certain amount of magic. And so in a certain way, these kinds of arts organizations or troops and things like that give us a different model.
But the trick is that you need both. I mean,
absolutely.
So, you know, Avner, you were talking about Avner the eccentric, Avner Eisenberg, he's been doing his thing for decades and he is a brilliant performer, but he has also figured out how to get out there in the world. Like he's teaching a workshop in Spain right now. He teaches workshops all over the world. He performs all over the world. You know, many theater groups go under because they don't have the business chops. Many, you know, visual artists can't get their work out there. So you need both. And there's just this tiny little slice that Artist Trust is addressing. But we need far, far, far more educating artists of all kinds in how to both participate in the economy that is built for them, some of which is the nonprofit world, which has its pluses and serious minuses, and how to for visual artists to get their work out in the world, which is something that's also, in addition to being difficult and complicated, is constantly changing. So we all need more training in that, and or people who will support it. Like if we, I feel like there could be people who are, it's kind of like agents, but I don't know, that's not a great description, but who would take on, you know, a posse of, I mean, and not necessarily galleries who are in it for a profit for themselves, but somebody who's sort of working to also to support themselves, but to support the artists and help them find opportunities for them. We need some new business models, but also, support. Artist Trust also gives a lot of grants and King County and For Culture. And there's but then there's grant writing. And a lot of artists I know are like, yeah, I spent a lot of hours on this grant and then I didn't get it. I don't get anything for that time. You know, we need some new paradigms for artists.
And when you think about the, even though I've separated the worlds, I think the organizational and business world has a lot to learn about from the spirit and the collaboration and the craziness the artist art world. And then, as you're saying, the art world often needs the other left brain capable of planning, helping to create models that work to get the art out in the world. So they don't have to be separate, although they have different energies about them.
Yeah, well, and you have these combinations. So here on the island, just even from, you know, like, UMO. I mean, just that little posse of people is just unbelievable, right? And so David Godsey and Janet McCoplin, they started Open Space for Arts and Community. And that for many years was just their thing. Now it's a nonprofit, but it's a space and it has lots of spaces within the spaces and it sponsors and creates performances and hosts performances, but it's also created opportunities for visual artists and their murals and their little fairy houses and lots of things like that. And then Martha Ensign and Kevin Joyce have Enjoy Productions and they sponsor a lot of commercial events. So they bridge the world where they will take all of our crazy, juggly, aerial performance-y friends and do events for highly corporate environments. And so, you know, they'll do bring that kind of world to these, to big holiday parties and different parties, and expose those people to our crazy people. And so they're bridging that world, and creating paid opportunities for the artists as well. So the role that they're all playing in doing that is really critically important. And the more people that do that, is great. Cause I know a lot of, kind of vaudeville circusy performers who are out there making money doing what they do, because people are creating those bridges to the corporate world and other worlds. In addition to people who are creating it for themselves, four friends of mine bought a circus tent in Bellingham, and they've created a Shoestring Circus, which is a new touring circus that did a run in Bellingham and Olympia this year. And so people are creating new things, and other, and people are flocking to it. They sold out 5 weeks of shows.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Jason Webley created a thing called Flotsam, which is a floating circus that was around here. And then they did last summer on the Mississippi River, and they're currently going down the Ohio River. And there's the Up, Up, Up Crane Circus, which is some other Bellingham performers that's been at Open Space a few times.
Yeah.
And anyway, so people are doing these things. And some of those shows actually have an interesting way of doing it where they're free public outdoor performances, and it's by donation. And so sometimes you can make more money by having something like that, which is a win-win because it's accessible for people who don't have money, but people might give more money than they would have if you charged tickets, and they wouldn't bother going since they didn't know what it was. And so they seem to Up, Up, Up and Flotsam seem to be doing pretty well.
Amazing.
That way, which is, it's really, really, really great. And they're fun, and they're quirky and goofy and wonderful.
Mm.
Yeah.
How neat. Well, first of all, I want to remind everybody to go on Vashon. If you're lucky enough to live here, go see Michelle's work at Swiftwater. And Plastic Cameras, I know it's still available from you. It's available online. That's the name of the book.
Swiftwater has copies of it.
Swiftwater has it.
Yeah, it's called Plastic Cameras, Toying with Creativity.
Is there going to be a third edition?
I don't know. There's a lot of turnover at the publisher, like in the publishing industry. And while some things have changed, it's holding up pretty well. The second edition came out in 2010, which seems like a long time ago, but a lot of the work is pretty relevant. Probably a lot of the website links in the book maybe aren't good anymore, but it shows portfolios of people's work, and that's timeless.
And it's a beautiful book.
Thanks.
You know, I'm going to underscore that. It's not just like a how-to or a little thing. It's kind of an art book.
It's a combination. It has portfolios of people's work, and so there's just the work, which is, like I said, is timeless. It's how to work with Holgas, and Holgas are still being made and sold, and other cameras, and it's some information about how to work with them, both in processing film and working in the darkroom. And the wonderful thing about darkroom film and film processing and printing in the darkroom is that technology has not changed. Like, I have the enlarger that I bought in 1991, and I just moved it last year, and I found the original purchase receipt for it, and it was bought in 1971. And it still works, and it's great, and the technology hasn't changed, and they still sell those enlargers. And that is a wonderful thing about working in the darkroom and working with film, is that you can get better at it. You can master it because the technology is staying the same, whereas when you're working on the computer, the technology is constantly changing, and so you're always having to play catch-up. And that is kind of crazy making. You always have to get a new computer. There's a new version of the software, and it changes things. You know, all of that, right?
Or you want to go into art mode, but in fact, you're having to go into tech mode because you can't get the password to work, and then stop.
Exactly, all that stuff. Right, and in the darkroom, you're just there with your smelly chemicals and, you know, all your things. But, you know what you're working with, and nobody can change that and take that away from you. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing about analog photography.
So what's on your horizon? Is there anything you see besides living life as it comes to you?
I don't know. You know, I've been off island for a while, and last year I bought a house on the island. So I'm back, and I'm doing a bunch of house projects. So that's a lot, and it's fun. And then planning a road trip in the fall. I've been way overdue to go to the Southwest, and I have a van that I've made into a camper. Like, I've only ever owned vans and I've just been a road tripper my whole adult life. So hitting the road for a few weeks in the fall, and I'm helping take care of my old dad. So, kind of doing all of these things right now and wondering what's next. Like, I don't really know what's next. And I feel like being back on the island allows me to be stable in a way that I know I'm here and I can be here, plus also back and forth to Bellingham still, and see what opportunities come up, which has kind of been how I've lived my life a lot, to kind of see what happens and see what presents itself.
Well, thank you so much for your time, because I had a hunch, and I think I'm right, that you exemplify a creative life, not just by what you create in your beautiful art, but how you do life. And I find that so interesting. So I really thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.